That's Lou Donaldson on alto sax with Blues Walk, the title track of his 1958 album. As you would notice by now that I really do like old music. Herman Foster on piano, Peck Morrison on bass, Dave Bailey on drums, and one of my faves, Ray Barreto on congas. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. Well, what have we going for ourselves today? We're going to be talking right now about the great farewell speech from his home city of Chicago, and just 10 days before he officially leaves office, President Barack Obama last night delivered his farewell speech to the nation as its 44th president. He astutely avoided talking about the stunning losses of the Democratic Party and his administration that ran into many obstacles, especially in the last couple of years, and most certainly in the 2016 elections. Instead, he focused on the many accomplishments of his two terms in office, made possible in large measure, he said, by popular support and engagement. He warned that such support will be needed again to put the brakes on some of the policies being contemplated by the Trump administration. We'll talk about the address today, if you were able to listen to any portion of it, paying close attention to Obama's penchant for rewriting history. Well, in the end, that's what a farewell speech is. Any kind of self-directed speech you would expect of this kind of speech, that it largely would focus on the good things the administration, and particularly the president himself, has achieved. Well, he has nothing to lose. He's going off into the sunset on January the 20th. The moving vans have already begun moving things out of the White House in preparation for the new occupant. But the purpose, remember, as we listen to speeches, we first must pay attention to the environment or purpose of the speech. It's a farewell speech. And even before you listen to the first word of the speech, you should have in your mind that the purpose of the speech is, of course, to recount the many victories, to, in some ways, warn, as he did, warn about the pitfalls that are to be anticipated with the new administration, but mostly to recall or recount the many strides that his administration had made. To, quote, set the record straight, unquote, it's a way also of doing that, because he's, in fact, creating a document, a historical document, and being aware of that, he wants to, in anticipation of being attacked, even after he leaves, he wants to be ahead of that, so he will present the history that he would like us and the world to know about his administration and about him, and also about what will come behind him. So that's the purpose of the speech. So in that sense, then, you should be prepared to hear a lot of things that favor him. Well, of course, he's writing the speech. He's not going to talk about where he has failed. He'll talk about where he has succeeded. So we should expect a greater proportion of the speech to deal with that, as opposed to talking about where his administration fell short. He's creating, again, a historical document. And so it performed accordingly. It just was about all the good things that he managed to accomplish, and in maintaining a certain degree of grace, did not attack Donald Trump, did not attack Republicans directly. He did so by inference. So we could fill in the blanks, but he talked about what should concern us about both Trump and a Republican administration. He talked about that in very, indirect ways. But we know that he was talking about Trump and the Republicans. But here, what troubled me listening to the speech was that, Obama just irritates me about this penchant he has for rewriting history. And here, he does it again. And I do understand it. I just don't like it. I understand why he does it, because he is, of course, as of January the 20th, we have to use the past tense, he was at the helm of state. So he cannot be seen as being self-indicting. And that requires many adjustments to the historical record. And repeatedly throughout his speech, he spoke as a statesman, and that involved making some major adjustments to the historical record. For example, when people start talking about this great nation of ours and how what it means to be American, and we're all in this together, and we're all equal under the law, these things irritate me because, first of all, we know it's not true. And it's even more condemnable when a person who allegedly is conversant at least with U.S. history and is conversant with the Constitution, you start presenting these things as if they were facts. And you talk essentially, you create this myth that we have always been and we continued under your stewardship to be a nation, we're all together. We all see things the same way. We agree about these high ideals, which are written down in a book someplace. And we become very, very patriotic. We all are on the same page with that. And that's it. Couldn't be further from the truth. Could not be further from the truth. So, it's no sense making a plea to Obama now. We've done that for the past 8 years, talked about his constant rewriting of history and misrepresenting the collective experience of the United States, giving the impression that the reality that we have experienced really is not what we ought to be bothered about. He puts on the record historical documentation that really does not exist or apply. The fact is, we have never been one. We have never been one. We have always had these battles with the falsification of history. And you're just kind of hoping that for once, you could deliver a very good speech without, indulging in the same awful practice of misrepresentation, historical misrepresentation, and out-and-out distortion of history. Let's listen to an excerpt here of President Obama addressing some of his milestones and his thoughts as he leaves office.
Our democracy is threatened whenever we take it for granted. All of us, regardless of party, should be throwing ourselves into the task of rebuilding our democratic institutions. When voting rates in America are some of the lowest among advanced democracies, we should be making it easier, not harder, to vote. When trust in our institutions is low, we should reduce the corrosive influence of money in our politics and insist on the principles of transparency and ethics in public service. When Congress is dysfunctional, we should draw our congressional districts to encourage politicians to cater to common sense and not rigid extremes. But remember, none of this happens on its own. All of this depends on our participation, on each of us accepting the responsibility of citizenship, regardless of which way the pendulum of power happens to be swinging. Our Constitution is a remarkable, beautiful gift. But it's really just a piece of parchment. It has no power on its own. We the people give it power. We the people give it meaning with our participation and with the choices that we make and the alliances that we forge. Whether or not we stand up for our freedoms, whether or not we respect and enforce the rule of law, that's up to us. America's no fragile thing, but the gains of our long journey to freedom are not assured. In his own farewell address, George Washington wrote that self-government is the underpinning of our safety, prosperity, and liberty. But from different causes and from different quarters, much pains will be taken to weaken in your minds the conviction of this truth. And so we have to preserve this truth with jealous anxiety that we should reject the first dawning of every attempt to alienate any portion of our country from the rest, or to enfeeble the sacred ties that make us one. America, we weaken those ties when we allow our political dialogue to become so corrosive that people of good character aren't even willing to enter into public service. So coarse with rancor that Americans with whom we disagree are seen not just as misguided, but as malevolent. We weaken those ties when we define some of us as more American than others, when we write off the whole system as inevitably corrupt, and when we sit back and blame the leaders we elect without examining our own role in electing them. It falls to each of us to be those anxious, jealous guardians of our democracy, to embrace the joyous task we've been given, to continually try to improve this great nation of ours. Because for all our outward differences, we in fact all share the same
proud title. The most important office in a democracy. Citizen. Citizen. So you see, that's what our democracy demands. It needs you. Not just when there's an election, not just when your own narrow interest is at stake, but over the full span of a lifetime. If you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, try talking with one of them in real life. If something needs fixing, then lace up your shoes and do some organizing. If you're disappointed by your elected officials, grab a clipboard, get some signatures, and run for office yourself. Show up. Dive in. Stay at it. Sometimes you'll win. Sometimes you'll lose. Presuming a reservoir of goodness in other people, that can be a risk. And there will be times when the process will disappoint you. But for those of us fortunate enough to have been part of this work and to see it up close, let me tell you, it can energize and inspire. And more often than not, your faith in America and in Americans will be confirmed. Mine sure has been. Over the course of these 8 years, I've seen the hopeful faces of young graduates and our newest military officers. I have mourned with grieving families, searching for answers, and found grace in Charleston Church. I've seen our scientists help a paralyzed man regain his sense of touch. I've seen wounded warriors who at points were given up for dead walk again. I've seen our doctors and volunteers rebuild after earthquakes and stop pandemics in their tracks. I've seen the youngest of children remind us through their actions and through their generosity of our obligations to care for refugees or work for peace. And above all, to look out for each other. So that faith that I placed all those years ago, not far from here, in the power of ordinary Americans to bring about change, that faith has been rewarded in ways I could not have possibly imagined. And I hope your faith has too.
All right. So that was a portion of the speech by President Barack Obama, his farewell speech as he leaves office after 8 years on January the 20th. Basically making the case that the future of the country will depend, as it always has, on engagement by what he lifted up above everything else, by citizens. It is the greatest privilege, in a way, he says, to be a citizen of the United States, but it carries... The term carries a lot of weight and a lot of responsibility for maintaining and protecting this great democracy of ours. So why is he really irritating me with this kind of talk? I know it's a farewell speech and, you know, he has to say these kinds of things, but geez, it should have occurred to him by now that a large portion of what it is he's talking about is a figment of his own imagination. And in some cases, for people like me, it's insulting. Why do I say that? Because the history tells us it's insulting. History tells us he does not have an accurate understanding of American history. And he is way out of place to insist that the responsibility for the continuation of this country depends on us, the citizens, the people. I mean, the record shows clearly how hard people have been trying to achieve some kind of parity, some kind of justice, some kind of equitable relationship between themselves and the apparatus of government. That's been the whole struggle in the United States, to compel organized government to actually respond to the people, to the citizenry. And he quotes a perfect example of what I'm talking about. You know, the great George Washington, the vision of the so-called founding fathers, who never intended that there ought to be some kind of equal footing between the people and the organized system of government. Never intended it. That's a historical fact. So now to lift this up again, he has done this time and again, and the system does it all the time, to distort history, to distort the historical record. And it irritates me because it supposes that we're idiots and we don't know what the truth is. This country has never, ever kept a bargain with the people. And this notion, it is especially galling to me that an African-American president should talk about this term, citizen. Because here is where the rubber meets the road for African-Americans and people of color generally. The history, the legal history of the United States centers on this one question. Supreme Court rulings, legislative initiatives, all centering on this one question. Who is a citizen? It has not been solved. It has not been adequately answered to this day. Well, let me revise that a bit. African Americans were provided an answer in 1857. In a U.S. Supreme Court decision, when writing for the majority, Justice Roger B. Taney emphatically said, the black man has no rights that the white man is bound to respect. That was a definitive declaration of who not just is a citizen, but clearly delineating who is not a citizen, not just in the time of 1857, but who in perpetuity is not to be considered a citizen of the United States. So that answer was provided for African Americans in 1857. And since then, for all kinds of reasons, none of them having to do with honesty, we have had this distortion here where the system, when it chooses, but it's only talk, it chooses when and where African Americans in particular enter the world of citizenry or citizenship. And just the same, although we were written off, we still had the duty. We still performed the duty, as did others, to protect this so-called democracy that he's talking about. African Americans died for it. A lot. They were denied privileges and rights. They were subjected to two different kinds of laws. None of that constitutional. He's talking about, well, if you don't like this system, just go get some, you know, go get a clipboard and go about the task of electing yourself. The history of voting in the United States for African Americans is abysmal. And he ought to know. The reason he's able to make a farewell speech as president is largely because the African American community turned out and voted. There is a history of oppressed people further adding to their oppression by electing people, especially from the Democratic Party, who proceed to do little or nothing to advance their interests and their well-being and welfare. It is very convenient when people are making speeches to distort the history of the United States. No other community has worked harder and longer and with such great sacrifice as the African American community to qualify for citizenship. But the record shows that the major battles that we have had to fight all stem from this question of who is a citizen, and the system clearly does not regard African Americans as citizens. If African Americans and other people of color qualified, as they deserve to be, for citizenship, then they would enjoy all the rights and privileges of citizenship, and we never have. Not even the right to life itself. We are encouraged, because other people also have distorted history in their heads, and they decide to democratize their ignorance by telling us a woeful tale. It has no basis in fact. All of these fights in the so-called civil rights era of the 60s, and by the way, the civil rights era did not begin in the 60s. Try hundreds of years before that. So this has been an ongoing battle. All of the civil rights movement issues that were predominant in the 1960s and that still continue to dominate our consciousness today are all connected to this single question. If you're a citizen, why should you have to fight for equal housing? If you're a citizen, why should you be subjected to a different set of laws? If you're a citizen, why do you have to fight for equal education? If you're a citizen, why do you have to fight for health care? And we discussed Obamacare, no matter what they say, is not health care. It is insurance payoff. Using, again, poor people as cogs in a huge industrial wheel that needs these bodies to justify exorbitant rates that they're charging. The government to provide subsidies for those who cannot afford insurance. If you're citizens, why are you being spied upon? Why are your leaders assassinated? Why are you unable in so many ways to feed your family? Why don't you have a job, even though you're qualified? Because built into this whole thing that he has romanticized here as the we are all one America, he knows very well, it does not work that way. And it was designed not to work that way. And yet, although designed against the interests of oppressed people in this country, they nonetheless have made a disproportionate investment in promoting democracy. Now you're going to talk about, well, what you're part of the problem. You're not voting. You don't seem to understand that it is part of your duty as a citizen to vote and to keep the system going. My question is, why should we? Why should we keep the system going? I mean, from 1619 to 2017, I would say that that's more than enough time to test the integrity of your argument. And it doesn't hold up. So people correctly should be pursuing alternative paths. They should have been at this a long time ago. The parties cannot and will not suffice as agents of democracy. That's not their intention. That is not their will. Even for the right to vote. African Americans literally had to die in order to secure their rights, supposedly, as what? As citizens. Now, it may be okay, and it's in fact expected, that these things do not resonate very deeply with people who are like presidents and so forth. They're beyond that. They're beyond history. Barack Obama has gone way beyond history. So it is all hypothetical and theoretical to him right now. It isn't a palpable sting. It isn't an ongoing wound, an oozing wound. It is not a deep pain. So they can encourage us all to trivialize or completely dismiss these realities and these historical facts. We are not one. We are not one. We are far from being one on every level. So now he's in the business, having been made to be the exceptional black. He's now the ambassador of historical distortion. And we are supposed to believe exactly what he says. The priority in our lives should be not survival, because that's where most every black person I know, that's the mode, survival. That is not what ought to concern us. The urgency, he talks about the urgency of now. Well, that's the urgency of now. The urgency of now is survival. And in order for us to survive, all oppressed people in this country, you have to throw away. You have to move away from, you have to dump the standing order, because it is against you. You have to devise new ways of operating so that you have a fighting chance to survive. And this is what we need to keep at front and center of our daily consciousness. We will encounter things like this, messengers bringing us false hope and false messages. I guess we could call this fake leadership, just like fake news. You know, we have fake leadership here. And we don't need it anymore. We need to end it. And it does require mobilization. It does require organization. And it does require an unforgiving attitude. Because we need to remember that we are way down the road on this question of who is a citizen. And it doesn't look like it will somehow be figured out anytime soon. We're not all citizens. We are not one in this country, not at all. So, as Mr. Obama sets about the task of building his legacy to himself, and the big building that is going to cost something like $900 million in Chicago, when all is said and done, he should be its first visitor to the library. Read a little bit of history. Educate yourself so that you don't miseducate others. And for us, we have to be on the alert. We have to be very real about our condition in this society. And we have also to be very real that it is destined to be pretty much the same in perpetuity, whether you get involved or not. We were warned since 1857 officially, but certainly the practices had been in place long before then, since 1619. If we want to play fast and loose with our own survival, continue buying into this myth. Continue buying into this, distorted version of history. Well, I was going to take a break, but we won't have time, the kind of time I like to allot for questions, so I'll move along, and we will address all of this in one fell swoop. Perhaps we can do Thursday and Friday. You will let me know what you think. Barack Obama wasn't having a great day, a monumental day all by himself yesterday. There was somebody else having a monumental moment yesterday, too. It was Hillary Clinton. What was her monumental moment? Well, I'll have Dick Morris, who was a very close aide and friend of the Clintons, who is now into political consulting and he's writing books, who has known the Clinton for a very long time, the Clintons, I should say, for a very long time. I'll have him tell us the monumental moment that Hillary Clinton experienced yesterday, the same day that her former boss was delivering his farewell address. This was what was happening with Hillary.
Hillary's bid for immortality did not end with her pursuit of the presidency. Today, Tuesday, she is going to Washington to the State Department building to dedicate a Hillary Rodham Clinton Pavilion named after her that will be right at the entrance of the State Department as you walk in. It's a glass pavilion, kind of a museum to the State Department. And it's one of four that are being installed named after secretaries of state. And she classes herself with Henry Kissinger and John Kerry, the current secretary of state, and James Baker. They all four will have pavilions named after them. But Hillary will be the one you see when you walk into the building. It cost $37 million to build. And she raised the money from her influence-seeking corporate cronies. The same crowd that gave money to the Clinton Foundation. Four Middle Eastern authoritarian regimes, Brunei, Kuwait, Qatar, and the UAE, gave money to it. Boeing gave $2.5 million to build it after Hillary went to Russia and got them to sign on to a $3.5 billion deal to buy airplanes. Intel, Pepsi-Cola, and a bunch of other of her usual suspect corporate cronies gave money to this museum. Now, Charles Rangel was the is the congressman from Harlem, and he was censured, almost expelled from the House, and stripped of his chairmanship of the Ways and Means Committee, because he helped raise money that went to the City University of New York for a building to be built that would be named after Charles Rangel. Well, there is no difference at all between what Hillary just did and what Charlie Rangel did. Both raised money. Both of the monies went to an agency of a government. Both of the agencies of government named the buildings after Rangel and Hillary. In at least Hillary's case, the money came from people seeking influence. So there will be an enduring monument in Washington, not just to Hillary's Secretary of Stateship, but to her corrupt use of the office and her use of the office to raise money for personal aggrandizement. The groundbreaking is today. The dedication is today. Let's all take our hats off. Thanks for watching.
You see, there's no one thing that applies to all. This is not a one-size-fits-all kind of government. Everybody can do what they want to do, providing they have the connections. You heard the kind of money raised in order to build a monument to herself, since it wasn't being done fast enough by other people. And what does it say about the respect just a plain respect. The nation's commander-in-chief and president is giving his farewell speech yesterday. It's the same day you choose to dedicate this monument to yourself at the State Department building. That, you know, you ran into the ground with all these crazy schemes. And you are allowed to do this. And people are telling us about government. We should trust the government. Barack Obama just, you know, in that little snippet that we played, is telling us that, you know, essentially we are the people responsible for this kind of craziness, this kind of lawlessness. This is his former employee engaging in these highly irregular activities and soliciting money, just the way we had talked about, and we will continue because there's a lot developing with the Clinton Foundation. She's able to do that, to build a monument to herself on government property, government land. And it's not like she's hiding. She had her dedication yesterday. Just to remind people that she's still around, still relevant, and still entitled to be exceptional. Nobody could do anything to her. Nobody could do anything about what she's done. She is a government unto herself. How about that? You see, when you see these glaring instances of corruption, I mean, brazen corruption, a total disregard for the law, an in-your-face insult saying, I am in charge here. I get to do what I want. Nobody gets to tell me what to do. I am above the law. Take your best shot. See if you will win. I will prevail. What a thing. Now, if somebody had said this to you and you said, come on, I mean, really? I mean, in the immediate aftermath of the scandals that have been haunting her, she does this too? She goes this far? To make herself immediately visible, she's basically authoring her legacy. I'm putting up a pavilion dedicated to me at the State Department, which I ran into the ground, and through which I performed all kinds of nefarious things, allegedly in service of my country, as its leading diplomatic representative. You have any idea of how psychotic you have to be to do these kinds of things? And shouldn't somebody be asking how this was allowed? Was there some kind of a poll or something to say who was the most significant or popular Secretary of State? And was this poll a poll of one person, Hillary Clinton? And she won her poll? This is the kind of madness that has been going on. And this is why the Democratic Party and political parties generally have no credibility really with the people anymore. The level of corruption that has been endured by the people, and who, because of, you know, you just heard it from Barack Obama, who are now expected to bear the burden of the consequences of organized government. Is it any surprise that people no longer, or a large percentage of people, are opting out of organized politics? I'm one of them. I did that almost 20 years ago. And I hate to say it, but I'm seeing similar modes of conduct even within the progressive community, doing outrageous things and daring us not to accept it. They can do whatever they want to do. They have no accountability to anybody. They owe no explanations to anybody for anything. And we are supposed to say, okay, but this is quite interesting. Very interesting. You know what? I think we ought to build monuments to ourselves all over the place, but in a different way. The monuments to ourselves would be to go back to the basics, honor our history, honor the sacrifices that people have made in our behalf, in many instances with their very lives. The monuments we should build should be to make sure that the political system understands that we're not playing games anymore. We're not putting up with the garbage anymore. We are not accepting this kind of treatment and this level of disrespect anymore. That's our job. That is indeed our responsibility. I tell you, yesterday was a powerful day, but not in the way most people would consider it. It tells us how determined the system is to play with our minds, to distort the truth, to have us be friends with a system that really doesn't act very friendly toward us. That we should cancel the correct path we ought to walk, which is seeing to our survival, our collective and individual survival. That's the number one task. You look at history and you see that's what our forebears did. They really did not believe in government, except that you have to be aware and you have to be always on the lookout for the things that they would do to harm and impede your progress. We have more than enough lessons in this regard to serve as a reminder that this is our number one responsibility, to see to our survival individually and collectively, because the system has proven itself unworthy of our support. We are reminded that one of the most important lessons that we should have learned from this election was that that is our truth. That is our reality. We cannot and should not relinquish the responsibility to ourselves and to our survival to a system that claims that that is its duty. You can trust that they will do that and do it well. No, you can't. And I won't let you, even if you could. My job is to make sure that I survive. In the same, with the same zeal that your job is to see that I don't, to put all these impediments in my path. You could call it democracy if you want. That would be your delusion, not mine. It would be your delusion, Mr. Obama, that we are one nation. Go right ahead and believe that. I'm sticking to the reality I know and the history that supports it. I thank you for joining me today. I thank you so much for allowing me the space to sound off a little bit. And we certainly will talk about this as you please. Probably on, we'll consider Thursday and Friday. Just let me know whether you're okay with that. Stay tuned. Coming up next, The Infectious Myth with David Crow, an excellent program. And you can reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com. Let me know whether you want to devote an extra day other than our Free Your Mind Friday to catch up with the events of the week. All right. Thank you so much. A pleasure and a great privilege, as always, to be in your company. Bye-bye.